3. Winter settled down over the Polana with cold and rain and the endless east wind blowing. At evening, under a ragged iron-gray sky, the flocks came in over the hills to the great paddocks of Esten. The fields lay gray and poor. The forest was gray, leafless. Jivana and Ladislas followed a steady routine, the girl as methodical in her housework as the man in his farm work. Amade lapsed into listlessness, finding nothing that needed his doing. At times he found it impossible to get up, cross the room, and trim a guttering lamp. The ounce of energy was lacking. He sat still. His need to make poetry had been his master. Having lost his master, he had lost his freedom. Like a tree grown up on a hill crest where the wind always blows the same, he had grown all in one direction, trunk and branches shaped to the wind, and the wind had ceased to blow. He would stand at the window for an hour at a time, looking out at the rain-lashed garden and yards, staring, not thinking, not wondering even why he had come here, and why he stayed here in this winter of boredom, this waste, this prison. The new year came, and in a burst of energy he wrote all his friends in Krasnoy, Itale, Karantai, Heleskar, Luisa, that he was coming back as soon as the roads were fit to travel. He wrote them long letters full of crazy puns and jokes. He would come back to the city in April or in May, when the lindens would be flowering along the Molsen Boulevard, and the chestnuts in the park, and the pretty women on the mall. He would leave behind him at wind-beleaguered Esten all his cobweb notions, his self-torment, the last senseless tatters of his adolescence. For that was all the trouble. Given up to his imagination, to the drunkenness of words, he had never taken time yet to become a man. It was time to face the real world. "What would I be running from?" he said angrily to the night, as if denying a grave, heedless accusation, and the wind went on in its tremendous tides to the west, to the sea, under Orion standing bright above the January hills. He thought of his boast and promise scratched in the stone of the Tower of Radico, "I shall conquer," the word now remaining both lie and truth, as enduring as the stone of the tower itself that ignored in its solitude all conquerors and all defeat. When Ladislas and Jivana called on their wide-scattered neighbors, he went with them, and they had people come in as often as they could, perhaps in an effort to entertain him. He was aware of their shy attempts to offer him work, or talk, or simply mute companionship, though he was not able to make adequate response. The evenings with other people were easier. The visitors did not really want him to talk. They were daunted by him as a poet, a famous man, a city man, and wanted, at best, to look at him, then to turn back to one another and discuss sheep, weather, neighbors, politics. The political arguments got hot. He kept out of them, listening with a sense of detachment and disloyalty. Ladislas was a strong reformer and constitutionalist, and was supported by the parish priest of Kolei. Most of the other dome and farmers combated his opinions, but not out of love for the government. Things were not going well in the country. Taxation fell heavy on those who had no cash to pay it. Police investigations and arrests were becoming common even in small towns, and the eastern provinces, where independence and conservatism were so extreme as to deserve the name of anarchism, were in a resentful, stormy temper. So Ladislas and his neighbors argued and grumbled, and Amade was silent, always with that vague sense that his silence betrayed something or someone. And when there were no other women, kept home by the bitter weather and the foul roads, Jivana also was silent, busy with her handiwork and with looking after the tea, the supper, and so on. She was pregnant, and beautiful in pregnancy. She had gained in self-possession. She was gentle, reasonable, timid in manner, yet Amade saw in her now also the unshakable strength, the assurance of her womanhood. She knew her way. She was happy. He watched her without envy or hope of participation. Ladislas and two neighbors were going at it hammer and tongs. She came over to the harpsichord, near which Amade was sitting, sat down, and with a smile of mockery began to play very softly. He came to stand beside her.
"Oh, they are so boring," she said joyously. "They'll never even hear this. It won't bother."
And she played and sang, half under her breath. "From out my tower window I saw the red rose and the may. From out my tower window I saw the red rose and the thorn. Who rides beneath my window before the break of day? Who rides beneath my window before the morn?" "Go on," said Amade, who knew it from childhood, the ballad of death who carries the girl away. But Givanna smiled and said,
"I can't sing. I'm so short-winded,"
and went on playing one of her quaint old sonatinas. When she was done, she turned a couple of the wires, which forever needed tuning, and then, sitting back on the bench, asked him,
"Do you still mean to leave in April?"
"I don't know," he said absently, his gaze following the design painted on the front of the harpsichord, a wreath of roses and hawthorn, chipped and faded on the cracked varnish.
"I don't want to leave." "Then why?"
"Because I know it's a mistake, so I do it." She played a C scale, one octave up and down, a tiny ripple of clear notes.
"It's foolish to talk that way."
"I know. I'm sorry."
"If you go, will you come back?"
"No, I don't think so. There is no reason to. I came here looking for the reason to come here, but I haven't found it. You see, when I went to Krasnoy, I knew exactly why I was going, what I had to do, to write my books, meet people, make my way, fall in love, all the rest of it. I did all that. I went through all I had to go through, and now it's done. It's all done."
"At 26,
don't think I'm lazy, Givanna. You've scarcely seen me work. I worked very hard when I had work to do, but it's done. So I can go back to Krasnoy or anywhere else and write articles and earn a living, take up life, as most people do, get married, go on from day to day for 50 years if I like. I can see that. But I don't believe it. I don't see my life ahead. I have already lived it. All the rest seems meaningless. Do you know what I mean? You foresee your own life to come in a way, don't you?"
"I never did until now. Since I've been pregnant, I see things as if the baby saw them dreaming. A summer evening out there under the poplar, the child and I are standing there waiting for Ladis to ride home, I suppose. And it's a lovely summer evening, a little sad, because the wind is blowing."
She smiled.
"And because I'll be older then."
"Do I ride home with Ladis?"
"That's for you to see."
They had forgotten the others. She spoke without the least convention, and he answered, harsh and pleading,
"But I can't. I can't see anything ahead. There's no way to see ahead through one's own eyes. It's the child, as you say, the future you bear. That's your vision, the truth. But I have lost the way. I can't see."
"You worked so hard. You said so yourself. You're tired. You're worn out. You have to wait. It's like winter. Everything has to rest and wait."
She spoke earnestly, with confidence. The thaws came early. There was no snow after the last week of January. In February, he received the first mail to come through to Kolei since Christmas. Two letters from Karantai, one dated in early December asking if he had any news from Itale, the other an empty envelope, the seal broken. There was also a packet from the Rochoy Publishing House, copies of his new book, Jivan Faujen. He gave one to his brother. "Read it next winter," he said, for Ladislas was in the thick of lambing season, at work 20 hours a day, and often not at the house for 2 or 3 days at a time. "No, in a week or so now," Ladislas answered seriously. "But give it to Jivanna. It will please her."
"I will. Where are you off to?"
"South Paddocks."
"I'll be along."
"If you like." Ladislas swung up on his little horse, raised a hand in salute, and rode off. Amade went to find Jivana in the garden west of the house. It was a cold day, the wind blowing light and keen. Sunlight flashed, dimmed, flashed in rain pools on the raw black ground. Jivana was stooping over a bed of dirt, her figure bright and frail in the restless light.
"My crocuses are up," she said proudly. "Two of them, see them? And my book's out. See it?"
She took the book, looked at the title, turned it over, did not know what to say. He showed her the flyleaf on which he had written with the bad pen and gummy ink of the Kolei Post Inn, "For Jivana and Ladislas from their loving brother Amade." She read the inscription and sought for words to say, then suddenly breaking through her own constraint, she smiled and said,
"Read me some of it."
She sat down on the garden seat, putting up her feet on a paving stone to keep them from the mud under the bench.
"Now?
Now,"
she said with her little air of command. Standing there in the uneasy sunlight, he opened the book and read the first page aloud. He paused and shut the book.
"It seems years ago. Someone else's book."
"Go on."
"I can't."
"How does it end?"
"You shouldn't know that before you read it."
"I always look at the end before I begin."
He glanced down at her, then opened to the last page of the book and read aloud in his hard voice.
"Jivan made no reply for some minutes, but leaned on the railing of the bridge in mute contemplation of the river, which ran fast beneath, foam-streaked and yellow, swollen by the torrents of spring. At length, raising his head, he said, 'If life is anything more than a brief exile from the kingdoms beyond death—'"
He stopped again. He closed the book and laid it down on the bench beside Jivana. She looked up at him, helpless. The wind blew. The sun shone out and faded on the high, pale hill above the house.
"It's a very gloomy book," the young man said.
"Amade, you are going back to Krasnoy, aren't you?"
He shook his head.
"But there's nothing for you here.
All my kingdom is here. It always was."
Hands in his pockets, he turned away to the gate, then turned back as if to speak again. He smiled a little as if in apology, shrugged, and went on around the house. Jivana soon followed him, wearied and oppressed by the cold wind. She lay down in her room and dozed uncomfortably. Through half-sleep, she heard Amade's voice down in the yard, the stamping of a horse. Rain began to patter on the roof and window, and she slept.
"Perhaps he went out to shoot in the forest,"
she said that night. Ladislas, at his long-delayed supper, nodded and went on eating.
"It's been dark 2 hours," he said, setting down knife and fork. "There's been some accident with the horse, maybe."
He got up. Jivana, watching his exhausted face, said nothing. He came back from the forest past midnight.
"Gilles is going on to Kolei with the lantern," he said.
Jivana helped him pull off his mired boots. He sat back on the hearth seat and almost at once fell asleep before he had lain down. Wakeful in her pregnancy, Jivana sat with him, keeping the fire built up. The old housekeeper brought quilts, and they made a bed of the hearth seat. Ladislas slept there until dawn, when he woke suddenly. Jivana was asleep, curled up in the armchair by the fire. Ladislas went quietly upstairs to his brother's room to check that no one was there, then put on his boots and went out into the icy white sunrise. The crest of the hill above the house was lipped with gold. Stables, yard, house, trees stood pallid and rigid in the dawn light. Ladislas pulled the collar of his coat up around his neck and went to the stables. The stable boy came clamoring down to meet him from the loft room.
"Where's the Rakava bridle?"
Ladislas said, his voice hoarse with sleep and cold.
"Did Dom Amade take it?"
"Aye, for the mare."
"I'm going out towards Fonte, by the old road. Tell them in the house."
He set off on his little black horse through the frost-bound forest, up the hills now bright along their eastern slopes, riding towards the summit and the tower that stood yellow in the level light. As he came over the last rise before the valley under Radiko,
He saw the brown mare standing halfway down the steep ascent, her reins dragging. She shied away as he rode close. She ran a little, stumbled on the reins, and stopped, turning her dark, nervous head to watch Ladislas. He rode up past her and across the fallen wall of the courtyard, dismounted, and went to the foot of the ramp leading up into the tower. Amade had set the gun, a hunting rifle, against his chest under the heart, and had fallen forward, sprawled out, his head turned to the side. His coat was soaking wet with rain, and his hair looked black. Ladislas touched his hand, which lay on the muddy ground, mud-stained and as cold as the ground or the rain. The wind kept blowing on the hills, the domain of Radico, as it always did. Amade's eyes were open so that he seemed to be looking westward over the ruined wall and the hills, at the sky where, for him, there had been no sunrise, the night continuing.